Welcome to the Week in Sports Cars and the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented to you by Cooper Tires and our dear friends at the Justice Brothers. And speaking of dear friends, it is our co-pilot, he of DailySportsCar.com fame, Graham Goodwin. How are you doing, my pal?
Way better than I have been, my friend. Just emerging the right side of really rough health post the double long haul. It's your turn to be away from home this week, though.
It is, here at lovely Circuit of the Americas for IndyCar spring training. And, you know, we did hear from your doctor, did recommend that while preparing your oatmeal in the morning, try water, maybe milk, leave the whiskey out. I think that's going to help on the health front a little bit, Graham.
And the gravel, yeah.
Oh. All right, so we have plenty of great questions. And I guess I should qualify that in saying we always have great questions. The questions, more often than not, are based on curiosity linked to a specific series, an event that happened, a piece of news. The questions we have, by and large, this week are just that, big, giant question marks with folks hoping to get kernels of knowledge, some insight, because there appears to be a giant lack of that in the preliminary entry list that has been revealed for the 2019 24 Hours of Le Mans. Just confusion, my friend. There seems to be confusion among everybody, but the two, you and I, those of us who cover this full-time, the teams in the paddock. I know you've received calls from at least two very major manufacturers, folks who are staples of the 24 Hours of Le Mans, saying, what the heck is going on with this incomplete initial entry list, and why aren't there some just basic names on there that should be?
Well, I think that's right. That's just to explain, if you're not aware of what the basis of this particular strand is, it was announced at the end of November last year that for the first time we'd see the 24 Hours of Le Mans entry list announced in two tranches. There's a reason for that. I'll come to that in a moment. But 29th of November, we were told, and it has not been changed since then, that the first 50 of the 60 entries would be announced on the 11th of February. With no explanation as to why, we got just 42 of those entries, and with very little to debate, they were frankly very predictable 42. It's 8 auto entries, and I know we've got some questions a little later about what that means. I'll come to that later. And 34 of the original 36 FIWC full season entries, the two absentees being the two Ginetta LMP1s. I know we've got a question about that too. What's not there in the remaining 8 missing entries that we expected to actually hear? Now, okay, it's supposition. It could be that there was an intention to do something with the ELMS teams or even some teams from Asia, but I doubt it. I think the original idea was that that would actually be fulfilled by the IMSA GTLM cars that have, over the last 3 or 4 years, bolstered the numbers whilst the LMP1 factory numbers have been reducing. And the reality is, we didn't see that. We haven't so far had confirmation of the Corvette Racing pair. I'm aware that Porsche have entered two cars from their US team, and I'm aware that Ford, Chip Ganassi, have entered two from there, plus Rizzi Competizione, although that, for a different reason, might be at some risk. The question, I guess, has to be asked, MP, why have we not heard, or have we not actually had those entries confirmed? And I think you can come to, one or two potential conclusions to that, one of which might be a bit conspiratorial, the other one of which is pragmatic and to do with the business or the ace, a booming Continental Series in Europe and actually reasonably healthy Continental Series in Asia. Are we in a position where the ACO are playing politics, or are we in a position where they are looking to their own business model and looking after potentially their own customers rather than completely bolstering it with every single factory car that's requested an entry.
This reminds me, Graham, and I'll step out of sports cars for just a moment. This reminds me of 1996, the Indy Racing League formed by Indianapolis Motor Speedway head Tony George, who had founded the IRL. It was its very first season. The kart IndyCar series, much more popular, vastly, hugely popular, the one that had been populating the race for decades. They were now a rival. The IRL, which nobody particularly cared for, wanted to protect their territory. So they came up with something called the 28-5 rule. The Indy 500 has 33 traditional starters, and they wanted to guarantee that their IRL regulars were locked into positions. So that's where the 25-8 rule came in. 25 spots guaranteed for IRL runners at Indianapolis. The other 8 were open to any who wanted to turn up. It stands, Graham, as one of the most hated short-term rules held at the Speedway. It only lasted a year or two and then went away, thankfully. I know that this isn't brand new, so I'm not saying that this is something new for Le Mans in 2019. I know this has been ongoing, obviously, since the WEC has really become a force of its own. It, compared to the IRL, is indeed something that is heavily loved, but I must admit, every year we get to this entry list announcement time, I'm just brought back to this 28-5 rule where, hey, those who compete in our full season championship, they receive the absolute bulk of the entries. We've also then officially aligned ourselves with auto entries from direct offshoots or direct partnerships with the WEC and the ACO, that being Asian Le Mans Series, ELMS, etc. And by the time you're done locking in and guaranteeing how many spots can be received to get into the race, you have this disproportionate thing where it's a club. Effectively, if you're not a member of our direct club or one of our direct affiliates, meh. It's not as if there's 30 plus seats or entries waiting to be filled. It's a case where, yeah, the number is smaller and smaller. So that, just on a very general premise, I don't know if and when that's going to change. I just know that it diminishes, from my perspective, diminishes some of the appeal of the event. So, and then making things a little bit stranger-er is knowing this, Graham, that we have so many spots guaranteed, auto-entried, you name it, knowing that that is the case, you would think it would be very easy then to lay out an expansive entry list, as you mentioned, 50 of the 60, not this 42, since it's a formality in so many cases. Plus, you do have some other things, like one thing that DailySportsCar.com Stephen Kilby wrote in his opinion piece, Corvette Racing, for example. I mean, they're celebrating, preparing to celebrate their 20th year.
20 years, yeah.
Right? They have an actual place on the track that is named in their honor. They're part of the brick and mortar. They're the longest tenured entrant. And not on this initial entry. Again, I'm just talking about the ones easy is this? Put it on, get it done, let them breathe.
You are completely correct. The problem has been caused here. There's doubtless multiple reasons why they've done this. The problem is, in the absence of an explanation, in the absence, again, of communication, then speculation reigns. And I have zero doubt, MP, that at some point in the near future I'll get a call or I'll be pulled to one side, a race meeting possibly somewhere in southern Florida, and, you know, asked to actually explain the tone of some of our editorials. And the answer to that question is going to be, well, you know, either you furnish us with the facts or you leave us to do the job of actually filling in the gaps. I'm unimpressed with this, I have to say. I think, you know, if we were told 50, there needs to be a reason given why not 50. And it wasn't given, you're then left to fill in the gaps. And you know what? I think I've been reasonably friendly about it at this point. The reality, I believe, is that there is a straight choice going to be made between whether or not full season, and for that matter, repeat full season LMP2 cars from the European Le Mans Series in particular get to go, or whether every single request from a factory for a GTE Pro is fulfilled. And I suspect we might see some trimming on the latter.
Amen, I think, or something like that. Let's get into questions. We did ask folks to send in whatever they had for entry list and other topics. Also, we'll note here that since I am sitting in the media center at COTA and we are going to have cars getting loud just a little bit, we have about an hour for today's show here on Wednesday, and I'm going to put this up right as soon as we're done with it. And I assume we will very likely have more questions left unanswered than answered at the end of that hour. So if need be, we will absolutely come back tomorrow with a part two just to get the rest of them. But just working with a little bit of a time crunch due primary reasons. I'm here.
After all the kind of the machinations we've just been through, should we get to actually quite a happy story? Because Jason Wuerl is one, and there's more a little further down here.
You know Jason me. I like happy stories.
Oh, happy's good. Jason says he's read that Keating Motorsport will run a customer Ford GT in GTM. Any word on the driver list? Any other news on the team?
Where could he have read that, Graham?
Might have been racer.com. Might have been Daily Sports. No,
big thumbs. Or else, big. I don't know if you can hear the clapping across the pond, but nice job on breaking that story, my friend. And, you know, we're not talking about the Pulitzer organization sending anything for it, but I'm just saying I love it when good work like that is done by yourself, plus the greater ramifications. What were we speaking about last week on the show, Graham? What will happen to the Ford GTs? Is there a possibility that they could become independent privateer run if the factory does shut down their full blue oval funding? And it's almost like they listened to the show and said, you know, we're going to provide those guys an answer. So tell us about this.
Well, look, I think it's two or three things. A second question, by the way, from Sol Heimis from the Rennick Group as well, who asks actually some more in-depth questions about it. Where did it come from? Last he heard, Ford weren't looking to sell. Could this be a possible extension of the Pro program? How does this knock onto Ford's IMSA interests, etc., etc.? Well, first things first, what I do want to say is I did try to contact Ben Keating through the day when we ran that, gave it 24 hours to presume that Ben at that point didn't want to comment. As it turned out, Ben called, was an absolute gentleman as he boarded a plane, having come down a mountain in Alaska doing something up there, I'm sure very exciting, but was a total gent about it. There will be a lot more information to come about this program, its scope, the sponsor, the livery. I believe that the car will be run by some form of offshoot of Ganassi at Le Mans. There are all sorts of ifs, buts and maybes about what the look of that car might be, and that might be determined by whether or not there is a fourth factory car. I think it is maybe a Ford that may be at risk that we might lose one of those four. But look, this is great news. It's not the first time that Ben, or indeed other parties, have expressed an interest in getting access to a Ford GT. It is, of course, the first time that that's actually been permitted. I think that's a very good move indeed. And for your point of view, MP, I mean, you and I had a brief conversation about this. It does indicate a willingness, should we be coming to the end of the factory programs, and I think we are, that those cars might find their way, albeit at some very large expense, into privateer hands.
That would be the perfect logical continuation of the program. A lot of money have been spent on those cars, my friend. I would hate to see them just disappear. The other thing, too, which this is just me being a geek fanboy, having seen Ben's Mercedes AMG GT3 wins liveried car, and you having seen that as well at Daytona,
yep.
I am dreaming of a wins livery on that Ford GT. That might be the most beautiful thing on the planet Earth if that were to happen. I'm going to try and dig into this a little bit deeper, at least on the American side. But yeah, I have to believe this is showing us the pathway to keeping Ford GTs on the grid. And you know, if the GTE Pro effort does get shuttered at the end of this super season, as we think it might, if we can have them in GTE AM, that would still be a win. Or if there's an angle for them to stay in Pro, albeit in privateer hands, there you go. But one way or the other, I just really hope that what is happening with Ben, with the story that you broke, is showing us that, yes, indeed, these cars can stay, as we touched on last week, and we won't get back into it again in any depth, but we are concerned about the health of GTE Pro / GT Le Mans. So if there's a way on both sides of the Atlantic where we can have them in motion, whether you're a Ford fan or not, it just maintains health in two classes that really need it, compared to some of the concerns that we explained last week about how that might take a nosedive. So great stuff there. Where shall we go next?
One quick thing to actually add to it, we shouldn't ignore either, and I know a number of people have actually said, look, there's Ben Keating, there's a man who knows how to deliver a tribute livery. Remember, it is the 50th anniversary for Ford as well of the final win at Le Mans by the epic Ford GT40. Let's see what actually emerges from there. Let's get back into briefly, MP, because I've got a number of questions here. Mike Hogg, Doug Bonham, both asking whether or not there's anything rumbling in the background over the IMSA invitational bids. The one missing part of the explanation I didn't give, by the way, in that preamble is, why did we have that split between the 50 and the 10? 60 maximum remote plus a 10-car reserve list. The reason for that is that because the Asian Le Mans series is finishing later this year, finishes in fact next weekend, not this coming weekend, weekend after, at Sepang. So on March the 1st, once we know the four automatic entries there, that gives the selection committee the opportunity to look at what which teams have been successful, look at where that leaves them with the remaining entries, and we know exactly how many entries they've had, 75 in total, and make some more informed decisions. No problem with that. The issue is this remaining eight. I go back to what we said earlier in the show. I think there's some serious questions here about what choices are being made and why.
Cannot argue, my friend. Let's see. You know, this, we'll just read this because we enjoy receiving questions from our pal Stathis Coco, who says, with his army service duties, he's fallen a bit behind on sports car news. No question, but sending wishes to the two of us and our families. Keep the faith. Excellent job as always. And they appreciate, and he appreciates what we do. So Stathis, thank you, brother. I hope that we won't lose your contributions while serving your compulsory service to your country, but do appreciate your participation here. Let's see. Hey, we've got a Bathurst question. I don't know if you've heard about that,
Robert,
or if you've ever been there before. Our pal Robert Northway says, a couple of weeks on from the Bathurst 12-hour, with this year one being one of the best races I've seen, I've been toying with this question in my head. Is Bathurst the perfect track for GT3 racing? It's one track that I feel the build-up isn't full of people complaining about BOP, so does it suit all types of cars? Great question, and also, what did you hear in terms of volume of BOP grumpiness?
Not a lot. I mean, there was a little bit of grumpiness about, oh, the Aston's got a lot of straight line speed, blah, 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 blah. But we've traditionally seen cars that are very, very quick down the straights, but other cars being remarkably quick across the top of the mountain, particularly the Audi R8 in past years has been particularly quick across the top of the mountain. But I tend to agree with you, Robert. It really does suit those GT3 cars. I think they're, in terms of raceability, about as quick as that track would manage. They are significantly faster than the V8 supercars, not as quick as some of the racing prototypes that we're talking about here to do with Le Mans 24 Hours. But it is a track and a place, albeit with pretty high risk areas, that is just about perfect for a blue ribbon event for those cars. There is a live debate about what might happen in the future about a supporting cast for the GT3 top class, and there were a number of people presuming that we might be two or three years away from perhaps in an almost all, or if not absolutely all, GT3 race there. I think that would be a shame. I think there is a place for, you know, some supporting Porsche Cup cars, the Class B cars, and also the Mark cars, and particularly the Mark Mustangs, which are finding some real speed. But yeah, I think you're right. It does provide spectacular GT3 racing, and it plays to the strengths of those cars, as we saw right at the end of the race. Matt Campbell, with a car that was by no means the fastest in a straight line, had to use his racecraft to find his way by in the most remarkable way.
Let's go to Oka Petterkamp. He says hello to the two of us, also wishing our families well. It's just a very friendly week here in the Week in Sports Cars presented by Cooper Tires and the Justice Brothers. Asks a question about Hypercar. It says, I've seen rendering of the Baikalis car project, and I've heard that Eureka / Rebellion are interested in the new regulations. Do you perhaps know under which name these cars might be entered? It also mentions the Baikalis car rendering looked quite generic, and said thank you and look forward to the podcast.
Well, I think the answer is it doesn't necessarily have to be under a particular brand. I think the preference is what it would be, but it doesn't have to be. I think there are certainly opportunities here. At the moment, I feel the situation with Hypercar, it's gone very quiet, and I wonder what is actually going on behind closed doors at the moment. There are two or three major areas of debate at the moment. Can this be done for the numbers that people are saying it can be done? But in particular for the cars that are taking your particular interest, okay, the Baikalis, they'll find a brand somewhere, Central European somewhere, to actually put on the front of that car. If not, I mean, bear in mind Baikalis are a team that has had Lotus branding in the past. Am I saying that it's definitely going to be a Lotus LMP1 or hypercar? No, I'm not. But they've done those deals before. As for the Orica side of things and Rebellion, well, it's got three letters on the front of the LMP1 car this year, TVR. I would be surprised if there weren't active consideration underway to talking in that regard. We've also had the same basic team involved with the Spyker brand before now. It's actually had prior motorsport experience both at, and of course at, in Formula One as well. So lots of conversations still to be had. In some cases it will be just a badging deal, I'm sure, and in other cases we might just see some of these aspirant brands stepping forward and wanting a bit of a slice of the pie. Let's wait and see what comes out. But for me, the bigger question is, let's find out when those bigger OEMs are going to step up. And there's a few more questions.
So Graham, with this, at least this Wednesday episode of the Week in Sports Cars, we normally try and drop things into very efficient buckets of questions. It could be WC, could be IMSA, could be fun. There's just a bit of a jumble this week, and so that's not a bad thing. Just means that for those who maybe like to fast forward to one specific section, we don't really have that, at least today. So hopefully you just like rolling along as we bounce around, because we just couldn't find super strong themes to separate things into. I'll take this one quickly from James Counter, who asks, what do officials look for in an accident investigation? After all the talk about the Bathurst incident, we assume he's referring to the Tim Pappas incident. You got me wondering. I doubt they look for fingerprints, etc., but what do they examine? Well, they'll do things, James, the obvious, which you would say is looking at what caused the crash, what initiated the crash. Was it driver error? Was it something where they were tipped into a spin or crash? Was it mechanical? Those are some of the very basics. What caused this thing? And at least as I understand the rationale and thought process across most forms of motor racing, it's not because they just want to have an answer on what happened for the sake of keeping a very deep book of every crash and why it happened. It's more a case of, is there something that might need changing? Was there something track related? Did the driver drop a wheel somewhere in a transition from pavement to, you know, dirt or grass? Is there something that they could control, possibly change or improve, to reduce the likelihood of that happening again? That's the one angle. Then you look, I would say, the meat of the question and what they would be looking at is, the physical impact itself. So after looking for the root cause, getting to what took place at the bottom of the chase there where he crashed, and the fact that we had two fans run over and grab fire bottles and then run to the car to tend to it, while we saw, at least on video, one of the corner workers walk kind of halfway over as the two spectators were jumping onto the track, onto the grass, I should say, to try and help Tim and put out the fire. My guess, if I'm investigating it, having done a little bit, not a lot, but having done a little bit of corner marshalling, and yes, marshal, the corner marshal is certainly a fun usage of words. Having done a little bit of that, I know for sure, and also having been a race director in a regional series in the Bay Area, having been on both sides at least, not to the extent of many of the super professionals who do this for a living all day, every day, I'm going to be asking questions about reaction time, response time from the corner marshal's post, if there were reasons why there was not an immediate response when the car crashed, why did at least one of the people at the marshal's post not grab one of those fire bottles and head straight to the car. It's trying to figure out what breakdowns took place. It was fairly clear there was a breakdown of some sorts. Obviously, you're looking for response vehicles, Graham. Is there a nearby emergency truck or similar that has all of the fire abatement bits and pieces? And, you know, was there an anticipation that there was going to be a vehicle driving up to the scene to tend to it? Or was it something that should have been on the one of the, if not all, the corner marshals there to jump in and intervene? Those are the things that you're going to be looking for, since we saw the situation was not tended to immediately or expediently, and two fans felt the need to intervene when they saw no action was taking place. So that, I would say, would be some of the more basic, but also some of the more comprehensive things that they might be looking at. And let me throw this at you, Graham. We're going to go to Carl Hartley here, who says, greetings from New Zealand. Hartley from New Zealand. Who'd have thunk about such a thing? Carl says, could you please explain how this auto-invite system works for the Le Mans 24? How many are handed out and to whom? He says, I fail to understand how you can get an auto-entry for winning the Michelin Le Mans Cup, but you don't for winning the GTLM Championship in IMSA. Keep up the good work, guys. And this might fill the rest of the hour, but we avail ourselves to your knowledge here. If you can, please explain or make sense of something that often lacks sense.
Well, there are 15 automatic entries that are given at the moment for the Le Mans 24 Hours. There will be an additional one this coming year for 2020's Le Mans. But generally speaking, they go for teams that are successful in some form of endeavor. So one goes, for instance, to each of the class winners of the previous year's Le Mans. For the European Le Mans series, the LMP2 winning car gets an entry. Next year, it'll be the first two in LMP2 of the 18-car entry this year for the European Le Mans series LMP2. Astonishing numbers. LMP3's class winner in the LMS also gets an LMP2 entry. The GT top two in the LMS both get GTE AM or Pro entries, depending on what they choose. It's always been an AM entry that goes forward. Quite right, Michelin Le Mans Cup, but only the GT winner gets a GT AM way forward as well, not the LMP3 winner. Two automatic entries for IMSA, which generally speaking go to the Jim Truman and Bob Aiken award winners, but in this instance this year the Michigoak-Borg handed that over to IMSA. They reallocated that to Cooper McNeil and the WeatherTech Racing squad, and then there are four that currently are still up in the air from the Asian Le Mans series, one for LMP2, one for the LMP2 AM subclass. LMP3 gets an LMP2 entry, and then the GT3 class winners get a GTE AM entry. Generally speaking, they are to encourage all season entries for the ACO favoured series, and in the case of IMSA, obviously there's that rather loose alliance at the moment. Seems a very loose alliance between the two, but it is actually just one of the ways in which the ACO looks to encourage people to enter their full season competitions. And a good example of that, and it's one that's attracted a lot of criticism, is that GT entry from the Michelin Le Mans Cup. The response to that criticism is quite a simple one. Every single team that has been awarded that automatic entry has gone on to basically promote themselves from a GT3 team in a support category to a GTE team, either in the ELMS or in the case of TF Sports, to the FIWEC. It simply works. It's as simple as that. Why don't the GTLM winners in IMSA get it? Because that's not been part of the agreement thus far. Remember that with the exception of Corvette Racing, the factory teams that are present at the moment in GTLM are also present in the FIWEC, and that means they get cars going anyway under their brand. They are able, as we've just been discussing, to offer up the possibility to ask for further entries. And I think the answer to that question this year on behalf of, well, not Corvette, I expect to see them, but Porsche, and for that matter, Ford, and for that matter, Rizzi Competizione, are going to be very interesting answers indeed.
I'm going to go to Garen Batten, and I love this one. A fun one for you guys. At university, my friends and I have a challenge to include the word catharsis in every essay or project. Have you ever had some fun challenges among your journo colleagues? And if so, can you tell us your favorites? What about you, Graham? I have one for this, but what about you?
I'm always, for reasons that I'm not going to go into, but for those in the know will find immediately hilarious, looking for things that are 50% more dangerous.
Give us some context here. Come on.
Should I?
Yes.
It comes on the back of the response to the very first circuit safari at Fuji. A spectacular success. With the public, with that matter, the vast majority of the media. I was on that bus. You may remember me doing some filming for WEC, for WEC TV and their social media, having some great fun with the fans there. And, you know, massively positive response. Every pop prospect that actually we might have seen that elsewhere happening. And then all of a sudden we started getting some moans and groans, and one particular journalistic colleague, and I'm not afraid going to name him on this occasion, basically came out with some ludicrous assertion, having been very positive on the bus, then decided, having listened to a couple of his journalistic colleagues who were a little more moany about it, to say that this was clearly very risky, and because it happened in wet weather conditions, it was, and I quote, at least 50% more dangerous.
Brilliant. I believe there are also some interesting stickers placed on the front of the bus, too. So that might have added another percent or two danger from what I've heard. I will guarantee this wasn't necessarily fun among journos, but I can tell you that, and they never knew it, and I still contribute to them about once a year, maybe twice, so I probably shouldn't say this, but my dear friends at Race Car Engineering Magazine, of whom I think I've written for since 2006 or 7, so good while now.
My brother used to work for them.
Oh, well.
He did.
More
he
evidence.
Probably submitted some of your pieces, mate.
More evidence they will hire anybody, or they used to. Mr. Cotton has gotten that magazine whipped into shape. So I can tell you that if you were to go back and read, I believe, every story I have ever filed to Race Car Engineering Magazine, you will find the word bespoke used.
Oh.
And just because. I don't use it that often. It's not something that is used. It's not particularly common in the good old America here in the United States. But yes, as someone who loves that word, I intentionally found a reason to wedge that into something in every Race Car Engineering article. It wasn't that hard, though, because the magazine, by nature of what it does, covering fairly interesting, unique racing engineering topics, there's lots of bespokeness, that might be a new word, to cover. So yes, that was my little bit of fun, little stupid Easter eggs that only I knew about. But yeah, I would say that would be my answer. Garen, let's see, where should we go next? Well, we'll stay on the fun theme. We'll go to our pal Joseph Ostrowski, who says, what's your favorite sports car meme? I recommend checking the Reddit group r/WC Circle Jerk. If you don't have one currently, I can just mention that our pal Andrew Baca had some during the Rolex 24 at Daytona that involved one was a Trojan horse. I rarely just out laughing out loud, howling in a media center, and Andrew got me. I mean, you tipped me to what was going on there, and that was brilliant. So Baxter, I believe, is his, at least on Twitter, BAKKSTER, I think. Anyways, look up Baxter's stuff and you probably have a very good laugh. What about you, Graham?
There's plenty. I think what tends to... I like the ones that respond to a particular issue or incident rather than the ones that go on and on and on. And yes, we've all seen the very... Isn't the BMW M8 GTE very big? And yeah, that's had its moment. But I just like the cleverness of the internet, the cleverness of you guys out there that can come back and just raise a belly laugh out of any particular instance. That, for me, is one of the joys of the internet. It's the immediacy of response and the humour that can come from, you know, at times rather challenging situations. But no, there's not one that really springs out, I'll be honest with you.
Wow. Well, let's go to Mike Kristoff. This is all part of the Bounce Around Jumbly Week in Sports Cars episode we have here. It says, hey guys, last weekend I had to drive all the way from the northwest corner to the southeast corner of Wisconsin, about a 5-hour drive. I thought I would knock out several podcasts along the way. .. Nope! Thank you for the extended edition of the Week in Sports Cars, which kept me from having to stop and find something new to listen to for 3.5 hours. Keep up the great work. Will there be a live episode at Sebring? Yes, there will. I don't know what it is or where it'll be, but yeah, we're going to make it happen at Sebring for sure. And also, yeah, I don't know if we really intended going in to do 3+ hours, but it just kind of worked out that way. So glad to hear that it was well received, at least by you, Mike. Let's see. Where should we go next, my friend?
We've got a quick one from our good friend Ryan Terpstrep, which is another one that follows on from the ACO entry list, particularly for Le Mans this year. And he's asking particularly, you know, why is it still 60? It's such a huge track, second only to the Nürburgring in size. Why can't they actually get more? Well, remember, it's not that long that it's been as many as 60. Just a few years, in fact, that we've had 60, 56, and back in my time, fewer than that. I think there's two things. One is they are getting to the stage where to make a next step forward would require a pretty major change in the infrastructure. That's going to cost an awful lot of money. With the limited amount of factory interest at the moment in the race, that money is not necessarily there in spades. So I think at the moment, the prospect of actually increasing that grid, I think, is pretty limited. It's not a bad thing for there to be more demand than actually supply in terms of, you know, getting people coming back for more, as long as it's an achievable aim. And I think that's the key at the moment. It is that thing around, well, of those, it'll be around 10 or 12 aspirant ELMS LMP2s. If you manage to get 7 or 8 of those in, that's a good thing. If you manage to get 2 of them in, that's a very bad thing indeed, because these are teams spending 7-figure sums, well, in the bailiwick of the ACO, and is this supposed to be something of a pyramid? So the answer there is, yes, I'm sure they could actually get more cars on that grid, but it would require a pit structure to respond to that. There is going to be the opportunity for them to assess that with the announcements last year that there's going to be new pits complex at the Circuit de la Sarthe from 2024. Let's wait and see what the numbers are that emerge from that, or whether or not we're going to have the same or a larger Granny Amex.
Let's go to our pal Right Turn Lover, Matthew says, if Baikalis could not come to terms with Nismo, Nismo being Cosworth supplying the Nissan-branded engines there, which engine options would they have come Spa on the Le Mans 24? He says they left AER, albeit before the introduction of AER's P60B engine, for the Nissan, and the Gibson-driven Rebellions needn't have gotten a weight break, and then there's also the current stage and state of the Mechachrome motor. So curious that with, what, the Baikalis having gone through two of the more prominent, I believe we're at two, I could be off, but two of the more prominent independent LMP1 engine suppliers, where might they be headed?
Well, okay, let's make it clear as to where we are. The initial intelligence on this one came on the back of the engine supply for the test in Aragon that happened before the cars were put on a ship and freighted now towards Sebring was underway. And it became clear that Nismo engines were not en route to Baikalis in time for that test, which effectively at that point meant either it was going to be a lot more expensive to supply them, i.e. air freight them, or it was not going to happen. So the debate appears to be now, taking both sides at their word, between payment for those engines and promise of performance of those engines. So that's the position as far as Nismo and Baikalis are concerned. If payment is the prevailing issue, then that, of course, is going to give them a problem with anybody else that might seek to supply. The blindingly obvious one to go for, because the team has actually had an AER installation before, would be AER. But that's going to mean clearly a new commercial agreement for probably two races only at this stage with Spa and the Le Mans 24 Hours. And it's going to mean a re-engineering, at least to a marginal degree, of the package. I think AER is the most likely. Mechachrome I would find unlikely, particularly if the moan and groan from Baikalis is about the performance of the engine. I know what the figures were supposed to be for the Nissan Turbo V6, and certainly they substantially bettered the actual performance of the Mechachrome that we know about. So let's wait and see from the always reasonably secretive Austrian flag team and see what we get in time for Spa, because if we don't get it in time for Spa, that is a team that's going to be in some difficulties.
Well, if there's one thing we know about the Baikalis team, very, very averse to change. I mean, they're just known as being one of the steadiest, most reliable outfits in all of sports car racing. Sorry.
Yes.
Sorry. The sarcasm BOP restrictor broke there and that leaked out. My apologies. Okay. Hey, here's a good one from Ben Gooding. Sorry, that was not meant to be a pun. With the current engine downsizing trend, was the Bathurst 12-hour the last time we'll see a car with a V12 engine lead a major motor race, referring to the Aston Martin and its glorious V12? I hate to say it, Ben. I think we might be falling into that area where my favorite sounding engine on the planet, or one of my two or three favorite sounding engines, architecturally, big V12 isn't really a thing anymore. And so I'm so glad that we have the legacy of Aston Martin's V12 to hear in rare occasion, not as many of those, more of the V8 Vantage type arrangement that we would hear now heading towards the turbos that they have. But yeah, I just, size-wise, not really something you would want to drop in the back of a prototype or a mid-engine GT car. It's something where if we look at how many front-engine GT cars, well, obviously front-engine prototypes are the super rarity, but if we look at front-engine GT cars, there aren't a ton left. And even the V8, if we look at the Corvette C7R, boy, you know, they have done an immense amount of work to take that motor and move it rearward in the chassis to improve handling as much as possible, knowing that they are going to a turbo mid-engined solution with the C8R. Yeah, I think, again, Ben, I think you're onto something here with just the sheer length and size of V12. It's becoming harder to justify in competitive terms, knowing, Graham, that essentially everything else is a much shorter engine and is either tossed in the back or moved super rearward in a front engine installation.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to get the treat of at least one more international outing for the old lady in the hands of TF Sports at Sepang next weekend for the Asian Le Mans Series. Johnny Molan and his Red River Sports customers.
He's come out of retirement?
Again! What? That is, no. I've worked it out. It's the 104th consecutive weekend.
Congratulations.
He's actually won more. He's won more races in retirement than he ever did as a professional. I'd say, but no, the one more there. But the other quick thing I will actually add to this one. I was actually having a quick look at the Reddit subgroup earlier, and they have a little thread there. Any questions you want, Mike, you want to chuck in for their collective? And one question was one of their readers asking which of three race meetings, you know, if you had the choice of going to in Europe, might you want to go to? And one of them was the LMS race at Monza this season. Will be a cracker. The reason I add this at this point is that, oddly enough, I was looking at something completely different last night and found that after a conversation at the Le Mans Classic with Pierre Fillon, the president of the ACO, as he stepped out of the glorious Panos GTR1, talking about the Masters endurance legends, those cars will be supporting the ELMS on the full Monza circuit this year. So
wow.
Not only are we going to have the 41 full season cars for the ELMS, not only are we going to get the Michelin Le Mans Cup with the LMP3 and GT3 mix, but we're going to get the LMP1s, LMP2s, and I hope some GTs as well. And I'm hoping the glorious Lola Aston Martin on that full and fabulous Monza circuit. And I'll tell you right now, MP, if we are going to see that, I'm going to be standing with the little Roland recorder on the podium at Monza to record that ambient sound for the Marshall Pruitt podcast.
We need to make that happen. Absolutely. Let's go to Tom Bacon next, Graham. And this ties into something we spoke on at length last week, but maybe we can expound upon it a little bit more. Tom says, are we likely to see Alex Zanardi make further appearances for BMW in IMSA or in the WEC? And I can at least fill in the Alex part. I asked him that same question at Daytona, and he was not willing to give any positive indicators that that was going to happen. There's nothing negative, but it was very much of a, this was an amazing invitation. I have truly enjoyed it. I also have Paralympic training to consider coming up here shortly as well, giving us the feeling that this was received by him as an amazing one-off, and he has other things that will be dominating his immediate future that might make a follow-up appearance at Le Mans or some other big event with BMW a challenge. But I think we also now have, as we discussed last week, the even bigger question of if and when Alex wants to do more a year from now, 2 years from now, whatever it might be, will there be an international BMW GT program for him to step into?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. Look at it this way. Alex's training program for the Tokyo Paralympics, which is next year, of course, is now firmly underway. It is a huge, a hugely taxing physical and mental endeavor. That clearly means we're not going to see him at Le Mans in 2019 or in 2020. And by that point, what do we know? We don't know whether the review that we already believe is going to be undertaken of the WEC program will have come to the conclusion that that won't continue. Neither, because the question wasn't asked, do we know whether or not the IMSA GTLM program will continue.
So, yeah, things that this is the obvious statement of the episode award goes to me. We would love, Tom, for there to be a program, obviously, for Alex to return to. That's all that we all want. Got about 10 minutes or so left, my friend. Why don't you steer us to whatever happens to tickle your fancy?
Well, let's have a go at one of our good friend Inuit's questions. He's got a couple, one about GT3. We'll come to that when we get a chance. But asking about the release of the LMS entry list, that 18 LMP2 cars, and ask the question, what are the benefits of the ACO FIA continuing to limit the number of LMP2, LMP3 constructors to a selection of hand-picked cars? There must surely be some positives, but I think A lot of other people struggle to see the logic behind limiting that. So do I, I'll be honest with you. We're now at this situation with those 18, where it is 11 Orica 07s. It is going to be 6 Ligier JSP 217s and 1 Dallara, a single Dallara. There is a single Dallara at the moment in the FIWC, and I do not expect the person who looks after that car to be continuing with that chassis into the following season. So we are rapidly, MP, getting to the point where from that initial 4, we're going to be left with a rather sad looking, well, 2 and the odd straggler beyond. So it doesn't currently stack up in LMP2. In LMP3, we've just seen, of course, the new regulations finally revealed with the new, more potent Nissan V8 engine, a version of the 5.5-litre Nissan that's something around 450, 455 brake horsepower. It's a version of the engine that's been previously seen in the GT1 spec Nissan GTRs, and for that matter in the Nissan Altima supercar cars. Safety improvements, some aero upgrades as well, and actually a reasonably cheap and cheerful solution to making those packages continue to be as accessible as they are. Again, we already know who the 4 chassis manufacturers are for those regulations. It will continue to be Ligier, Norma, now owned by Decane Engineering, Adesse, and Ginetta. So let's wait and see what the announcements we've seen in recent days, not just to do with LMP3, but also to do with LMP1, of course, how that might affect the balance there. What you've got at the moment is Ginetta obviously selected for new LMP3 program, and we will actually for the first time this season see a Ginetta LMP3 in action in the Asian Le Mans series at Sepang. But with their LMP1 program having been given very firmly the thumbs down at this point, at least by the ACO, with those two cars not being selected for the 24 Hours of Le Mans, I simply don't know what response you're going to see from the organisation in West Yorkshire that is looking very much to build a pyramid in sports car racing, and with, bluntly, not a great deal of help for the powers that be.
Pyramid schemes in motor racing, we're going to try and avoid those. Ah. Oh, wait, oh, different thing. Different level to that, for sure. All right, Mr. Goodwin, let's pick a few more and then say farewell.
Let's have a quick look. Effective Sprinkles, another one of our Redditors. The LMS Grid looks excellent name. The LMS Grid looks stacked with great teams and talents. Any team that stands out as title favourites right from the bat. Also, how great is it LMS is doing so well after being almost dead only a few years ago? Love to be critical of our friends at the ACO. No one can deny they did something right here. It does seem to be a package that has really gelled. The four-hour race format works at that level. It keeps the cost down, but it means that they can actually stack those cars with 3 drivers. The new LMP2 regulations have been picked up and run with there. LMP3 suits it quite nicely. And we've got an increased quotient of GTE cars. I was talking to my LMS co-commentator Johnny Palmer, who's still actually out in the fabulous country of Australia for the next week or two, and he is pumped as I am ahead of commentating on that one. Standouts, there are too many to mention, to be honest with you. United Autosports moved over to Michelin tyres, and that's, by the way, one of the other big changes this year for the LMS, is Michelin have made great strides there and now have the dominant number of cars in the field. Sad to see Racing Engineering leave, having finished second in the order, championship order last year. You'll be hearing in the coming days and weeks what they plan to do for the 2019 season, but it isn't in ACO world. Well, Panis Bartes competition, stepping up to 2 cars. That's two Ligier teams. Decane Engineering and Edex Sport have both got very good prospects as well. Watch as well for High Class Racing stepping across from their previous Dallara equipment to the Orica for this season. But frankly, of those 18, I think you can honestly say there are probably at least 14 of them that you would do very well indeed to say have got no chance whatsoever of making a podium. It's going to be a cracker. Better still, though, MP, lots of new teams as well, including a name that's now familiar to fans on both sides of the Atlantic, with Carlin Motorsport actually stepping into LMP2 for the very first time, with the solo Dallara, with Jack Manchester, their young driver. Why the Dallara? Because Jack's too tall to fit in an Orica or a Ligier. It's going to be a cracking season in the LMS, and I think we're going to get an increasing number of questions on the weekend sports cars as that comes along, because for me, that is going to start to be a championship that starts to turn heads beyond its traditional fan base.
Let's do this, mate. I'll grab one question to close, and I think we might come in just slightly under 1 hour. We'll see. And then we will get to the rest in a part two tomorrow, maybe Friday if necessary. But hey, a two-part week in sports cars, not necessarily the worst thing in the world. We'll save the last question here for Zagato 28. So slightly off topic, there's no such thing, by the way. Has there been any news regarding the Aston Martin DTM program? And also mentions, love the show. So tell us about that, Graham, right? A thing that was not exactly a straight-up factory thing, but kind of a thing. What do you know? What's new?
Well, I think you're going to hear very, very soon about some more details of it. We've got some information in the last couple of days about the body that's going to be brought together to build those cars. It'll be a two-car entry, certainly initially. It comes from the organisation that runs the R Motorsports effort that did so well at Bathurst, AF Racing. Two Swiss doctors, Florian and Andreas, involved as well in the background with a number of Aston Martin programmes, particularly the Valkyrie programme. They are part of a consortium that puts together the buying consortia for these cars. Their customers tend to be very high-end Aston Martin customers. I have heard a couple of rumours about who the drivers will be for those DTM cars. They're rumours only. I can tell you that if they are, the rumours are correct, that you are going to be talking about additional drivers to the DTM ranks that we've not seen before, which is another interesting development, one of whom is a young and talented driver from the single-seater arena. But I think we'll be hearing in just a few days' time.
Well, let's say farewell to the weekend sports cars on a lovely, super lovely February 13th here. I'm Marshall Pruitt. That is Graham Goodwin. We thank our partners at Cooper Tires and the Justice Brothers for all that they do, helping us to make the show possible. And if you've got more questions, go ahead and send them in. We will wrap them up with a part two coming here before the end of the week. Mr. Goodwin, get some rest, get healthy, stay off the stripper poles.
Will do, mate. And you enjoy your Indy cars. What have we got in the background at the moment?
That's actually Indy Lights being led by Zachary Clayman DeMello, young Oliver Askew is second, and from Holland, Renus VK is third. So all kinds of good stuff there. And I'm going to go get some work done that involves more talking, just not in the recorded podcast form.
Good stuff. You have a great day, and we'll speak later in the week.